Fine. So, as you said, my name is Andrew Askew. For those of you who don't know who I am, which as of Monday was, I think, pretty much everybody, I am but a humble experimentalist here on behalf of the Atlas and CMS collaborations to tell you about alternative new physics at the LHC, which immediately provoked the question, what's alternative? In this case, it just means not Susie. Ian did a good job of doing a lot of the heavy lifting yesterday of going through Susie at the LHC, whereas I get all the fun stuff left to go through the non-standard signatures, and they're arranged as per my own particular biases. Okay, so I don't need to really motivate it. If you don't see your favorite alphabet soup up here, don't worry. I was just trying to fill up the top of the slide with all the different models that have been bandied around. My mission here is more or less just to express to you the general sensitivity of the LHC experiment to various modes of new physics. And what you get here is the intersection of what's been approved by Atlas and CMS with what's going to be available early on, in my opinion, and what we'll be able to do with those things. And so I've arranged this to certain, of course, non-SUSY signatures, and I've arranged by signatures, as you'll see. And this is going to be a play in three acts. The first act is the conventional. We have a very friendly looking dog here, very standard pet, very familiar to most people. And this represents more or less the methods by which we've teased physics out of previous collider experiments, dileptons, leptons plus missing ET, trileptons, these sort of modes. And then, and I'll spend some time with this guy, but then I'll proceed on to the unconventional. This is a hedgehog, which I'm told makes a good pet if you know how to handle one, which is the emphasis that should be placed on the unconventional searches. And these things, perhaps at the writing of the TDRs, would have been considered, well, they're not things we designed the detector for, they're impossible. And with a certain amount of ingenuity interjected by thoughtful experimentalists, they become merely difficult. And then I'll say a few words at the end and sum up with the unexpected, which is this gentleman here, and I'll leave it at that for now. So as an outline, I will go through these traditional collider search signatures. And then by unconventional, what I'll review here is the searches for heavy stable charged particles, which is not one of the things that you typically do with a collider physics detector. We like things to be prompt and in time with the beam crossing. And high activity events, such as you would see in black hole creation and evaporation. And then unexplored, I'll get to at the very end. And of course, all of this is tainted with my fiercely experimental bias about what you'll be able to do early on with different modes of searches. And they will pull my union card if I don't show the apparatus at least once. Here's the LHC ring. Here's the location of the Atlas experiment. Here's CMS, her sister, who is all the way across the ring. The nominal beam energy, of course, is 7 TeV on 7 TeV. Leandro gave us a wonderful overview of this on Monday, so I won't go too far into detail here. But I will put the caveats that are important to me, which are that we're going to be starting at a center of mass energy of 10 TeV. This is a plot that I've stolen from some folks who immediately upon hearing this wanted to know what happened to our reach. This is Z prime mass for a given Z prime with a given coupling, so whatever you wish to factor with here. This blue line is the Tevatron. This red line here is 14 TeV, this green line is 10 TeV, and this is luminosity. And of course, it's weirdly luminosity needed for one, luminosity integrated in 1 year to detect 100 Drellian events of Z prime goes to E or mu. The estimated integrated luminosity that we will get in this year, we're supposed to begin running this year, is 40 inverse picobarns, and you should apply whatever optimistic or pessimistic scale factor you wish to this 40 inverse picobarns. That's not a very well-known number. The studies that I will show will highlight large-scale, high integrated luminosity, almost perfect detectors, and I'll try to bring that down to startup scenarios and give a flavor of both the early and final sensitivity of the apparatus. All of the things that I'm going to show here assume 14 TeV. Just the studies haven't been redone for 10 TeV. That's happening as we speak. Sir? Let's see. This is actually an instantaneous luminosity. So it's even a weirder scale than you'd like to figure with. But the intersection of the two, that's the operating instantaneous luminosity for this amount of LDT, and T is set at 1 year. So it's a weird scale. I didn't make the plot. It's meant to demonstrate the fact that we still do have some reach, even if we're not at design energy. Again, I still have to show the apparatus. We saw a bit about ATLAS earlier. It's a lot like what my old thesis advisor would have called, you know, you've seen one standard particle, general purpose particle physics detector, you've seen them all, you have a tracker, calorimetry surrounded by a magnetic field. ATLAS, of course, has these very innovative new muon detectors with the air gap toroids on the outside. Here's a nice picture for the scale. There is a puny human, and this is the Death Star. CMS detector, if this graph looks smaller than her sister on the previous slide, that's because she is a great deal smaller, but in fact a great deal heavier as well. CMS is not what he would have described as a typical particle physics detector, as the calorimetry is inside the magnetic field. And that field's return lines go through the iron yoke, which gives you a non-uniform field out here, very uniform field in there. There isn't a good picture of CMS that goes with the perspective that you got on the ATLAS one, because ATLAS was assembled down in the pit and CMS was assembled on the surface and lowered a piece at a time, which if you've ever watched it descend an inch at a time down the hole, millions of dollars of apparatus dangling precariously, it's a little bit nerve-wracking. So here is the hadronic calorimeter about to be inserted inside the solenoid. Here is the fully installed electromagnetic calorimeter that appears to have eaten the technician. And here is the beautiful all-silicon tracker outer barrel, which would, of course, go inside there. So if you shove all these together, you get a completed CMS detector. Okay, the conventional. Cleanest signals that I had, sir. Go ahead. Not really. And in fact, in the transverse direction for CMS, you're completely hindered by how big the experiment hall is. Now, I'll get to a little bit of the sensitivity to really long-lived things when I cover unconventional, but we'll see that. So leptons are the most conventional signature because they're rare at hadron colliders. So I'll start with dileptons, diphotons, then I'll go on to leptons plus missing ET, then I'll go on to trileptons, and then finally leptons plus jets. When I was organizing this, I subconsciously organized it as per how we'll be able to do these signatures on startup. First, you'll do dileptons signatures. You'll find the J psi, the upsilon, the Z, and then you'll search for the Z prime. Then you'll start trying to understand your missing ET. So here, this gives you a handle on understanding your lepton efficiency and acceptance. This gives you a handle on understand your missing ET as you're looking at the standard model W, and then later looking out in the spectrum for the W prime. Once you've understood both your leptons and your missing ET, you can go on to look for things like WZ and things that decay to WZ and try lepton modes. And then finally, there's no getting around it. You have to understand your jets, and it's generally the last thing in terms of scale and resolution that you will understand, all of which is my bias. Dileptons, I have a long checklist up here. There are plenty of scenarios in which you generate a Z prime. The signatures that, of course, we mercenary experimentalists look for our Z prime goes to leptons. I mean the friendly leptons, not the tau, which I like to call the devil's lepton. And you've got some more recent ones like unresonances, which aren't actually resonant behavior. You have indirect sensitivity to things that are produced in association with dileptons spectra, which you can get a handle on through the angular distributions of the lepton decays, and technicolor. Now, I could do probably a half an hour on just dileptons if I was to go into detail on one of these. So I'm just going to paint with a broad brush and pick a couple of examples. So this is the CMS slide. Here I've chosen an RS graviton decaying at 1.5 TeV. This is a continuum Drellian background. This is 30 inverse femtobarns. Of course, you have to take into account how strongly the RS graviton will couple to leptons. And so that is, of course, dependent on what you choose that to be, how big this peak will be, or if it's visible at all. The bottom plot is an early running scenario of Z psi to mu mu for a 1 TeV Z psi. decay to muons with an early alignment in 100 inverse picobarns. So what we do these studies is we take the detector, we purposefully munge up the alignment, and then we see what happens to the resonant peaks that we expect to see on these spectra. And in fact, as Meenakshi said earlier on Tuesday, we also do things like exercise the techniques that we'll use to actually estimate the backgrounds from the data. We do Monte Carlo closure tests to make sure that we've at least got our assumptions in line. So when you misalign the detector, you take these resonances and it's like you press your hand down on them and smoosh them out to the side. So your resolution goes to heck, your efficiency goes to heck, you spread out the resonances and they become more difficult to see. But even if with 100 inverse picobarns here, this particular model is still quite evident over the background. This is a dilepton slide from ATLAS. I've chosen a very similar plot for the electron channel up here, large continuum background, a very fine peak on top of it. And the bottom is a Z-chi decay, and this underscores what I was saying earlier. This is for several different alignments of the ATLAS. This, again, is muons, because it's the easiest thing to go ahead and screw up, because you know you're going to have to align your detectors. You have several different alignments here, one of which is quite frankly horrible and ridiculous, the other of which is perfect, and the truth will lie somewhere in between. But even for a very misaligned ATLAS detector, you can see what kind of sensitivity this apparatus has to be able to do a dilepton signature in the mu channel. Lepton plus missing ET. This is a plot that was mentioned on Monday as well. You have to be able to separate your W prime or what have you from the bulk of the standard model W decays, which are their predominant background. And to do that, you're going to have to understand the missing transverse energy in order to properly model this. This is a slide from the Desire experiment that was shown at CalOR 2004, and it illustrates, not that D0 didn't understand how to do its missing ET, it illustrates that as you begin running one of these large-scale apparatuses, they have what a colleague of mine called warts. They have blemishes, they have imperfections that you have to learn to deal with through the operation. And of course, some of the worst ones here are there's no correction for the cell level energy, there's noisy events that needed to be removed, you have noise within your electronics, you have broken electronics that gives you missing ET, and then finally you've removed all of the badly behaving parts of your detector. This is a slide, as I said, that Slava Sherry showed at CalOR 2004. When did Run 2 begin? Anybody recall? Run 2 began in 2001. Okay, so that should set a scale for your kind of expectations for early missing ET. It's a convolution of all the experimental problems you can have in your detector by its very nature. Nevertheless, let me go on and assume it works. And this is a W prime search from CMS in the muon channel. And in fact, for the selection, this has no cut on missing ET. This is merely a demonstration of how starkly such a single lepton signature would appear over its backgrounds in the event of a high mass W prime that decays to a high PT lepton. This plot, however, is transverse mass, which means you need to understand your missing ET in order to be able to make this. You can cheat a bit. You can do vetoes. You can ensure there's little jet activity, and that'll restrict you to understanding the resolution of your leptons, which is why this is second on the list. But in the end, you have to contend with everything if you wish to do missing ET. This is a slide from ATLAS. These, in fact, aren't the final ATLAS plots for searching for W primes. These were with just simple kinematic cuts and nothing more clever. And I put them here because I think it's magnificent the way that these just leap out at you in transverse mass. It's several different W prime models considered here in both electrons and muons. And it's just manifestly different than the continuum background here, which is from your just W to mu nu and W to E nu decays. Okay, trileptons. So you've mastered missing ET, you've mastered your leptons, at least to the extent that you think you need to in order to go search for trileptons. And this can be a sign of Technicolor or W prime. You can substitute a W prime that doesn't like leptons in this diagram, and you get this again. And the leptons will be understood early, and the missing ET will take time. This is an early plot from ATLAS with 30 inverse femtobarns of integrated luminosity of a decay of a technopion to WZ. The yellow background here is just the standard model WZ continuum production. This is the four-body mass of the three leptons in missing ET, where you've made an assumption on the neutrino PZ and solved for the mass. This is the corresponding slide from CMS. Again, this is a Techniro at about 500 GeV. And again, we've made these assumptions. And you can see the distribution of the different backgrounds here from the green, which is just continuum WZ. But on top of that, you have to pile on ZZ and Z plus jets in the case of lepton misidentification. And of course, top is included here. That's the plaque. It's a histogram stack. Okay, leptons plus jets. The additional complication is, one, you're going to have to develop your jet energy scale in situ. There's no avoiding it. But two, neither the ATLAS nor CMS calorimeters have ever observed a jet. Everything we know about the resolution of these detectors comes from the simulation. That's an important point, because I'm not sure, again, drawing from previous experience, the D0 detector ever got to the promised jet resolution for run two. So you need to factor that in as well. It's not just your knowledge of the scale, it's your knowledge of the resolution of these things. And so I've picked a couple of models here. I picked the right-handed W with a heavy neutrino, but you can also do leptoquarks this way. It depends on how you combine this final state together to get both each sign of physics. The first is the right-handed W up here. The black is the background. Here's your sign of your heavy neutrino. This is the plot of LJJ, and then you combine all four together to form MLLJJ. To see your peak that corresponds to your right-handed W. This is for 30 inverse femtobarns. That's a very big peak. You can do the scaling, I'm certain, in your head. Just take a factor of 10 and then scale appropriately. Early result, leptoquarks pair-produced at a mass of 400 GeV from ATLAS. First generation is on top, for, of course, electron plus jet, and then there's the bottom one, which is muon plus jet, second generation. This is for 100 inverse picobarns, though the jet energy scale is assumed to be well-known, and of course, the jet resolution is assumed you perform as per expectation. But even if you, again, you take your hand and you smush this peak down, this is a very clear signature if you see it in the lepton plus jet mass. Okay, let me go on to the unconventional. Some signatures are unusual, but they receive more attention. Black holes are one of these. The heavy stable charged particles, meaning, and by heavy I mean slow moving as well, produced in collisions. So black holes, you create them in a collision in extra-dimensional extensions of the standard model. And the handles are rather fierce as far as an experimentalist is concerned. Particle multiplicity at a hadron collider, we always have a pretty fierce particle multiplicity. Just saying there's a lot of stuff around doesn't get you a lot. Ratio of leptons to jets more interesting because there's a correlation there. And of course, event sphericity is very important because these things are evaporating and QCD tends to be quite planar. Here's a slide from CMS just to give a kind of flavor. Ignore completely the scales here and just look at the distributions. The top is the sphericity. The more spherical you are, the further you go to this side, and here's what your background looks like. Here's what your black hole would look like. Something in common between CMS and ATLAS, which is fairly obvious, is that we require the black hole to be fairly massive in order for us to look at it in these ways. This is a very massive black hole, 4 TeV. This is the invariant mass of the decay products. This lead off here is where we end up, we miss things that have substantial contributions to the reconstructed mass. And then, of course, there's a continuum where we mismeasure. This is a slide from ATLAS. This top reconstructed mass is very similar to the previous one, but ATLAS shows that when you require a high ET lepton, it may hammer on your statistics slightly. This is a 5 TeV black hole, but the conclusion stands. If you require a high ET lepton, you completely slaughter your backgrounds because your continuum high multiplicity QCD event is not going to have one of those guys. Heavy stable charged particles, as an experimentalist, I have to reduce everything to a set of letters. For universal extra dimensions, the standard model particles have Kaluza-Klein partners, which can be pair-produced. There are also GMSB and Split-Suzy models, but those aren't alternative enough for this talk to really be covered. So If you've got a really heavy stable charged particle, it's going to appear somewhat like a super muon. It's going to go ahead and ionize its way through your detector. And if it's light enough, oddly, we'll be able to measure its beta as it goes out through the detector. If it's too heavy, it's too slow, and by the time it reaches the muon system, you'll be on to the next crossing in the tracker, you'll lose the information, and so there's a window of sensitivity in which you inhabit here. So the CMS tracker, though we bemoan its thickness at times, that very thickness gives you a measurement of what the DEDX of the particle is. By the particle punches its way through, it deposits a certain amount of energy that correlates to its V over C. We measure beta, and we can correlate this to, once it reaches the outer muon system, we can correlate that time to when it would have had to leave the interaction region, and that leaves you with an almost completely backgroundless signal. There's not many times you'll hear an experimentalist say backgroundless, because there's plenty of things that can do this. Things that involve timing are one of these things that you can count on to do that. So your prompt, your fake guys that come from muons will all be in time with the beam crossing a lot closer, and you won't see this correlation, and that leaves you with just these two models. This is for a 300 JeV one, and this is for an 800 JeV one. And that effectively there is no background to this. Okay, the unexpected. A sad truism is that we can really only find things if we're looking for them. We relied completely on spectroscopy. Someone had once famously, pronounced, we'd still be searching for the top quark. We'd never see it if we were merely looking at all these different particles coming out. So if we're searching in the wrong haystack, that's what my orientation here is per signature so dangerous. Because if we're looking in the wrong haystacks, we'll never find the needle that goes with it. And we're starting to consider, both CMS and ATLAS, models like the Hidden Valley and quarks that give us signatures that aren't even unconventional. They're weird. They're out there. They're not what we designed these detectors for. They're impossible. Give me a week. What else could we be missing here? Due to the enormous data volume, the problem is not archiving all your data. The problem is being able to process all of your data that these experiments are going to collect. I have trouble conjuring with a petabyte. The Tevatron experiments have a petabyte. We're talking about petabytes per year when we start operating at design for LHC. So if we don't get out there and make the tweaks to the reconstruction to get the information that we need for these, we may lose the opportunity. And that should be the nightmare for us. So quickly, the quark query, which is not in fact Lewis Carroll. This is a weird idea for a certain lambda value. Your quarks will oscillate, as we've heard from previous talks, but these quarks will stay connected and leave the detector like this, and they'll leave a very strange track within your tracker. But like monopoles, we'd need a different tracking algorithm to be able to reconstruct these guys. And it's not unheard of for collider experiments to do that. Take a subset of the data, completely reprocess the tracking with a different algorithm to see if you can find things like this, but you have to do the development, or again, the data will outstrip you. I stole these from Dr. Strassler, ripped them off a previous talk. For these Hidden Valley signatures, these are again very alien, and I wish I had a slide from your talk earlier this week, because there was the one where you had a particle or glue ball completely leaving the tracking region, missing the ECAL and decaying within the hadronic calorimeter. That's my nightmare, because jet cleaning will even kill that guy. These guys are very challenging. These are very displaced vertices, and it requires serious algorithm changes to efficiently observe these guys. Like I said, both CMS and ATLAS are considering things like this. That's going to be gone forever, but this guy could be salvaged. And if they're high enough energy, if they have leptons, they'll end up on tape. This guy here is a different story. He's got leptons. Remember, green are leptons for these event displays. Multiple jets, leptons, we're going to trigger on this guy, or at least we're going to make an attempt to trigger at this guy without even knowing that he's there. But unless we're looking for the proper quantities in events like these, they're going to end up in someone's top background. and it'll get, you know, the horrors that we perpetrate upon theoretical calculations. It'll get rescaled out for in like WBB. It'll be hidden within the K factors, and we'll ignore it. It's not something we'll stumble across. I'm almost done. So I hate to end on a down note, and so what I want to end on is a kind of powerful message here, is that the detectors are nearing completion, unless you're thinking of something for the upgrades, and I don't think a bigger hull is intended for the upgrades, in fact. There's not going to be any changes there. And we're tuned up on a lot of physics, and we're ready to launch searches. This should be our mission goal, is to launch these searches and look at this data. But there's still a small window where we can change the trigger. There's a large window where we can change the trigger. That just changes the luminosity we'll get exposed to. Changing the reconstruction is harder and requires serious development. And so if there are more things like this so that we can capture more physics, then this is one of the reasons I'm here at this conference, to collect these ideas and bring them back and make sure that the correct ears hear them so that we'll get this stuff. Thank you.
All right. Questions for Andrew?
When you say correcting the trigger algorithm, what level do you talk, and what do you mean precisely?
Well, typically I tend to think in terms of CMS, because that's the collaboration I'm a member of. We have a high-level trigger that looks at global event quantities and things like that. That's the level at which I would think about changing trigger things, and that's the most achievable level, because the other things require changes to the underlying hardware, and those are either difficult or impossible to do. Can't hear you.
Yeah. The high level trigger is the one that is more easily changeable, because it's based on software, basically.
Of course.
And this is the. But also, I don't know exactly for CMS, but also the level one, to some extent, is flexible enough to be accommodated. Some signatures. For example,
yes. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do with level ones of these.
I disagree with you, for example, that, or maybe I misunderstood, that we cannot trigger on slow particles.
No.
This we can.
That's not what I didn't mean to imply that.
I misunderstood, sorry. And yes, I mean, for example, the level one trigger hardware has been designed and optimized for relativistic, for example, in the case of muon spectrometer, for the muons, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still configure this trigger in a way that you can eventually trigger on something different. The only problem, and this is more related to the luminosity of the machine, will be the intensity of the background. From background here, I don't mean the QCD or any other background. I mean
accidental
neutron background. So we are talking about milli electron volt background that can induce occupancies in the muon chambers and then oblige to tie the coincidence time window. The real problem, and then I stop, is with the association to the bunch crossing.
Yes, and I meant to imply that in my remarks here. If you can still, I didn't mean to imply that you couldn't trigger on these slow moving guys. The problem becomes the data alignment, so that you make sure that you. Yes.
I don't know if you actually have studied this yourself, or if you're closely aware of it, but if you do know something about the timing issues at the CMS, I know something about the timing issues at Atlas, but I don't know very much about exactly what CMS has to deal with, and I'm curious to know what, if indeed you trigger on something which is a bit late, for example, do you lose it, or if you trigger on something which is early, do you lose the late?
The real problem here is the data alignment, effectively, is what we're trying to say here. So you can. you will get, okay, let's take the heavy stable charged particle, which was my example. So it propagates out slowly, and it gets to the muon system, and that would trigger. But if this slow-moving information, now we're onto a different bunch crossing in the tracker, you don't get the information with it in order to measure the beta, because that stuff went with the previous one. And so you're onto a new bunch crossing, then you see the muon trigger, but there's no longer its track.
Well, a certain number of events are still in the, are kept in buffer.
Right, so, and that's, I think, was, what was being referred to.
Maybe you should
here.
Ask it this way. Right, it's, so, I've, so it's, I know, it's kind so for of Alice, I know question. It's kind of, second?
It's kind of an open question. I've been conversing with people who have been studying precisely this, and it's not clear whether you can make exceptions and make sure that you still have this in the buffer, or...
Well, I guess I'm sort of confused about a general thing, which I suspect that if there were an answer to it, and I understand there might not be, it would be a little bit easier for me as a theorist and probably for others as well. If you trigger on an early object, can you see a late object? Or if you trigger on a late object, can you see an early object? Which is worse? For example, in these events that have the heavy charged particles, you might trigger on jet plus missing ET because where the heavy guys were going, there's nothing yet, right? So if you have a hard jet plus two of these
right.
guys, you might
but
trigger
you don't
on
have
that.
But you don't have a guarantee that you'll trigger on the crossing that contained his information. Is that what you're going for?
Well, what I'm asking is whether that information, whether the information about the next couple of bunch crossings, which would include these heavy muons, would be retained, or whether it's in fact the other way around.
It wouldn't, no. I mean, modulo some heroic measures to try to game things, which to me seems very difficult to do.
I can say something for others, I'm not sure for CMS, but when you have a trigger, for the one or two, for surely for one, bunch crossing next to the one gave the trigger, you are not sensible. Not sensitive, if you will. At least for one. So, eventually, all the physics information you have are in the data that are collected by the trigger you had the bunch crossing before. You cannot trigger with a separation of one bunch, two events, one after the other. And I think this is the same for CMS.
Any other questions or comments? All right. Let's thank Andrew again. And next is Lian Tao Wang, who will be...